Good afternoon. I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. My name is Lindsay Smart, and I'm the president of the Actuaries Institute. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this second banking seminar run by the Actuaries Institute. Now, our Banking Practice Committee has done a great job of organising some very interesting speakers and sessions to bring to you this afternoon on a range of issues in the banking space, but notably capital. And the issue is of particular interest to members of the profession who work in the banking sector, whether it's in risk or capital management or other roles. And it won't be news to you that the rapidly changing regulatory and competitive environments represent challenges, but importantly, opportunities for Australian banks. And we hope that today will shed some light on the backgrounds driving these challenges and provide some insights and perspectives across the industry. Now, I also want to foreshadow that a little bit later in the year, the Actuaries Institute is going to be releasing a paper on banking capital, and that will help policymakers as they deliberate. Now, before I hand over to Peter Sinkus, who will chair the first session, intriguingly titled Bubble, Bubble, Toil or Trouble, I'd like to warmly welcome our guest speakers, and especially those that have made their way from interstate to join us today, Sean Dooley and Professor Kevin Davis. We're really looking forward to today's presentations. Now, these events don't just happen, and we appreciate the support of our sponsors. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, SKL, and also our supporting partner, the Australian Bankers Association. So a couple of housekeeping items. Just please make sure you have your mobile phones set to silent or however it's not going to disturb us. And if you want to keep up to date with what's going on Twitter, then use @actuariesinst is the item to use there. So, without further ado, please welcome Peter Sinkus, who will chair our first session. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Lindsay. My name is Peter Sinkus, and I actually, as well as being part of the Banking Practice Committee, also work for NAB. I've been pretty excited to get together today's session and some of the speakers involved, and particularly being able to rope in a couple of my colleagues from NAB today to bring forth some really interesting light and some interesting challenges that are coming up ahead for the banking seminar. So, unfortunately, a third speaker today for this first session, who might be in your programs, wasn't able to make it due to other commitments that came up this morning. But we do have both Sean Dooley and Peter Jolly today to speak to us. So, Sean is the Group Treasurer at NAB, and he was appointed back in September 2015. Treasury at NAB is responsible for all the liquidity, the funding, the capital, and associated risk management with those areas, including transfer pricing within the bank. And prior to this, Sean has a wealth of experience. He led the Enterprise Risk Function, which was responsible for the measurement, management, and monitoring of credit and operational risk across the group, and that covered both retail and non-retail credit risk, as well as elements of compliance. It also encompassed at the time our subsidiary banks in the UK and, of course, our New Zealand subsidiary. He's been with National Australia Bank for over 24 years with a number of different senior appointments. So we're really excited to have him as our first speaker today and to enlighten us into our first part of our session on Bubble, Bubble, Toil and Trouble with some really interesting new thinking that's been developed over the last few months. So, Sean.
Thank you, Peter, and welcome everyone here today. It's probably the third time I've spoken to the Actuaries Institute now, a couple of times in prior roles talking about either risk appetite or risk culture. Thank you, Peter, but also welcome to the people we have on the webinar. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces here, some friends, some colleagues, and others that I'm meeting for the first time. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about what I think is a really important and pertinent issue. And I'm pretty impressed with the lineup of the speakers that are coming after me too. So I think you're in for a treat in terms of the current thinking around balance sheet, unquestionably strong, and particularly around capital. What I really want to focus on today is sort of what are we doing as an organisation in terms of translating regulatory change into balance sheet action. I think Peter covered pretty well what my role is, but it's essentially my job is to be, though, I guess, the forefront of interpreting regulatory change, not only domestically but internationally, and what that might mean for the future shape of the balance sheet, both in terms of the composition of the balance sheet, how it's funded, but also what the capital looks like and the composition of capital. What I'm going to talk about today in my presentation is really the various dimensions of regulatory change. There's a lot going on, and really to try and outline for you why an integrated view of regulatory change is so important. I'm then going to talk about the net stable funding ratio, and then I'll introduce some what we believe is relatively new research into the dynamics around the deposit system. And then also touch on what my thinking is around unquestionably strong. And I think we're privileged to have Kevin with us today as being one of the authors of the Financial System Inquiry, and certainly unquestionably strong is a key feature of that, which we support entirely. So regulatory change, there's a lot happening obviously in this particular space, and it's coming from many directions. So internationally, we've got the G20, which has mandated the Financial Stability Board and the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Domestically, we have many actors, APRA, RBA, ASIC, and the Financial System Inquiry, which I mentioned before. In Europe, we've got the EBA, the ECB, and the European Commission. And then in the US, we've also got the Federal Reserve, the SEC, and the FDIC, amongst others. And we also have our own stakeholders in terms of their expectations around how we're required to implement what I believe is really a strengthening of the risk management framework and the risk profile of the system, and how that will play out in terms of individual banks. But it's essentially looking to build a safer banking system in response to I guess, the issues that we experienced in out of the GFC. So what I've outlined here is probably the key major aspects of that regulatory change. It looks a bit like an explosion in an acronym factory, but for those that are not familiar with each, on the left-hand side with net stable funding ratio and liquidity coverage ratio, that's basically ensuring that banks have much more stable and secure funding, both in terms of the short-term and the medium-term. TLAC is total loss absorbing capacity, and that's a measure of to both risk weights and also to leverage, and that sits along the side of the capital ratio to ensure that we've got strong underpinnings in our capital base to support our depositors and also our bondholders, and leverage basically deals to, I guess, one of the observations of banks through the GFC that through a variety of sort of funding and product means became highly levered, and certainly the leverage ratio applies for many banks that are on the standardised model a constraint around their balance sheet. In terms of the agenda, we've laid that out on the bottom, but certainly mortgage risk weight changes that were implemented by APRA, or announced by APRA last year and then implemented by the banks on the 1st of July this year. We're moving into greater clarity on what unquestionably strong means for the system towards the end of this year, and APRA are working hard on that at the moment. And then as we move into FY18, we've got the standardised approach to counterparty credit risk. We've got obviously changes to the securitisation framework, and then also the measurement of interest rate risk in the banking book, which Australian banks carry capital for, many banks offshore don't. And then into 2019, we've got the fundamental review of the trading book, which basically looks at the boundary between banking book and trading and the capital that's required to be held against those. We've got new standards coming out on operational risk globally and how that will translate into the Australian environment. and then on an ongoing basis, credit value adjustment and how we measure the influence of credit for counterparties generally. So the challenge for us as an organisation, as it is for our competitors, is really trying to optimise the balance sheet within the constraints that are placed as an envelope around what we do. And it's optimising, obviously, our liquidity and funding position, obviously the capital, and ensuring that we are able to generate a return that's attractive for our shareholders. And certainly that looks to exceed the cost of capital over time, so we can continue to attract capital that we need to support our growth. But there's a lot of moving parts on this. The Basel Committee certainly has a stated intent of finalising the rules by the end of this year. But that being said, you know, recent events still call into question the ability of regulators and politicians in Europe to really move the ball forward, particularly I think some recent events around Italian banks and actions or statements by governments around their preparedness to potentially use taxpayer money to support Italian banks does start to put a question the efficacy of the TLAC regime. So we certainly support APRA's approach on proceeding cautiously around TLAC and how that plays out, because there's quite a number of different models that are in practice around the world, and working out what suits the Australian system, I know, is uppermost in APRA's mind. And I welcome Wayne, who's just joined us at the back. So welcome. Good afternoon, Wayne. So net stable funding ratio. So this is a key policy setting. This sits alongside the LCR, and it's proposed to implement this from the 1st of January 2018. So I'll spend a little bit of time sort of outlining what I think the implications for the system are, because I think they're pretty profound. And there is still consultation underway between the industry and APRA, and I think we'll start to see some more updates from APRA towards the latter part of this year. But essentially what the NSFR seeks to do is to more closely match the maturity characteristics of our assets to our liabilities. And banks have typically borrowed shorter and lent long and through the economic process of maturity transformation, but in doing so that comes at an increased risk profile. So the regulation is essentially looking to manage that risk profile and ensure that our term lending assets are adequately funded with stable forms of funding. And from our perspective, the net stable funding ratio has particular implications for business lending. As you can see on the chart there, that you know certain activities, so deposits from households and mortgages to households, are typically accretive to the net stable funding ratio, and then dealing with business customers is typically decretive to the net stable funding ratio. So looking at the composition of the system overall and the composition of individual banks' balance sheets, you'll end up with a different outcome in terms of how that ratio plays out. This does have implications, potential implications for business lending, and this point was picked up by the RBA in their most recent statement on monetary policy, where they said that the net stable funding ratio may also influence the composition of banks' assets, given that unsecured lending to businesses and households generally requires more stable funding than housing, which is secured lending. So one of our roles is to try and optimise the balance sheet, support our customers within the constraints of the overall, and constraints is probably the wrong word. I mean, it's an envelope of measures that's essentially looking to ensure that the system remains stable and safe, which is fundamental for obviously for Australia and the performance of the Australian economy, and one that we're all absolutely aligned to. In terms of our own balance sheet, so I'll just touch on what we've been doing over the last couple of years, and really over the last 10 years our balance sheet shifted materially. The proportion of our funding, which is sourced from stable forms of funding, that is wholesale funding with terms greater than 1 year, plus also deposits, has increased from below 75% to nearly 90% now. We're also lengthening the tenor of our funding. It's moved from an average of 3.5 years to maturity to about 5 years now. And personally, I don't actually spend a lot of time thinking about weighted average maturity. For me, it's really around the buckets of the maturity profile. And if we We look at transactions that have been executed by ourselves and also our competitors. And even last night, CBA executed a transaction where there's a lot more 10-year funding that's being issued by banks. That's a market that that is open for banks in the US, particularly in Europe. We haven't been yet able to really lengthen the investor preferences for term funding in Australia, but there's certainly something we need to continue to move investors from the sort of current five-year sort of threshold where they're based. But with the introduction of net stable funding ratio from the 1st of January, we're looking to lengthen our tenor profiles and ensure we can manage our maturity and concentration risks accordingly. And, you know, that does come at a cost. In terms of our reliance on short-term wholesale offshore funding, we've reduced that, as you can see in the chart. So there's two areas of short-term funding that we focus on. There's the aggregate of short-term wholesale funding, and then what we source from offshore. And certainly the way we look at our structural balance sheet, our customer loans, essentially funded by term funding and deposits and part of the equity stack. If we look at our liquids, they're funded more by short-term funding and obviously part of the equity stack. And what we've been looking to do is to reduce the proportion of that wholesale offshore, the short-term wholesale that is sourced from offshore, and we've brought that down over time. And then lastly on capital, the volume of capital funding the balance sheet has increased significantly and probably has doubled over the last 10 years. What this chart sort of outlines for you is basically the responses available to a bank to solve for the net stable funding ratio. So remember, we're trying to get the available stable funding to the bank in excess of the required stable funding. So the various drivers that we have, we've got capital, we've got wholesale funding, and we've got deposits on the balance sheet side. Clearly, we can continue to increase the capital, and banks have been increasing capital over time. And there are various forms of capital, including not just common equity, but also tier one, tier two, and potentially loss absorbing capital. Capital is expensive, so you know the increased capital comes at a cost, obviously, and a potential drag on return on equity. In terms of wholesale funding, I mentioned that just before, we've been increasing our tenor. One of the things that we're focused on is making sure we understand the capacity constraints that exist for the Australian banking system. Certainly, we've all been successfully issuing larger amounts of longer-term funding over the last year. We've increased our term funding by about 7 to 8 billion, or nearly sort of 25% this year from where we thought we'd be at the start of the year as we've moved into transition to comply with the net stable funding ratio. Our competitors at Westpac and CBA are amongst some of the largest issuers in the world in terms of bonds. So the health of the system, the health of the Australian economy is particularly important in terms of the sentiment that investors have. And certainly when I do roadshows to investors offshore, the questions are almost, the majority of the questions tend to be about the Australian system first in terms of housing. And Peter will talk about housing later, and Peter gets similar questions when he's on the road, but housing, resources, agriculture, the influence of China particularly on Australia, and people are really looking to understand the macro direction of the Australian economy and how that flows through to the capacity for banks to continue to issue. So we've been fortunate in with a pretty stable, strong system relative to much of the rest of the world, and it's important that we continue to develop that strength overall. We size our issuance based on where we think sort of a reasonable capacity constraint might be to ensure that we're not overextending the reliance on those offshore markets, because the domestic market is relatively fixed at the moment, and we all access as much as we possibly can in the domestic market because it is still the cheapest form of funding in terms of wholesale funding relative to those offshore markets overall. In terms of deposits, you know, clearly we could look to increase our share of retail and SME deposits. We can look at the mix, or we can increase the deposit tenor. And there's some constraints on the system, which I'll touch on in the rest of my presentation, which we want to share with you. Obviously, on the balance sheet side, we can look at the composition, mix of housing assets versus business assets, and that needs to line up with our strategy, and it needs to line up with our returns. But we can also look to ensure that we're optimising the balance sheet in the through the use of netting and other forms of credit credit mitigation techniques. This this market this slide adds a spend a little bit of time explaining what it is, but essentially what it shows is the period of time. Before I start talking about deposits, I just want to make a general disclaimer that anything I say now about deposits and the deposit system is not intended to be an indication of intent or price in any way. There's no displays no forward guidance on future pricing, because I know there are a number of competitors in the audience here today. So the discussion is very much theoretical, and the implications that the system has for market competitions, and their general comments only on market dynamics and the implications of regulatory change. So with that important disclaimer, I would like to talk through this chart, which basically says the deposit market is highly competitive. What each bar basically is it's an individual bank, and you can see the colours on the table there. I won't seek to identify any bank, nor should you, because it's not the point. The point is that the ability of a bank to grow its share of the deposit market through leading with price is very transitory. The average price lead, that is the most competitive bank in the marketplace, is only for about 1.4 weeks. And what that means is if one bank leads with a price, other banks will respond, and you'll see the market adjusting accordingly. So the ability of banks to try and influence their share of the market through price is very difficult to achieve, and it's very, as I said, very transitory. So if customers respond to price in the way that we've outlined in this particular slide, there's no sustainable way of growing market share. But as I said, using price to try and grow that is not possible in our view. So if the answer is not to grow market share through price, how does the size of the deposit system grow, and what can influence that? And conventional textbook thinking really presents two traditional views. One, and you'll be all familiar with this through your economics training, but banks act as intermediaries, lending out deposits that savers place with them, and banks multiply central bank money to create new loans and deposits. Now, new thinking on this subject explains why these views are probably no longer valid. This work's been led by the Bank of England, it's been supported by the RBA, the ECB, the Bundesbank, and the New York Federal Reserve, and the current thinking suggests that it's actually credit that generates liabilities. And this makes sense from a practical standpoint, as banks and borrowers determine how much lending is done, and that credit then finds its way into deposits. And the Bank of England made this comment themselves, and that bank deposits are mostly created by the banks themselves, and they're far more important for the creation of bank deposits is the act of making new loans by banks. When a bank makes a loan to one of its customers, it simply credits the customer's account with a higher deposit balance. In that instance, new money is created. So what this slide seeks to do is to demonstrate that on the before and after, how the creation of a new loan will actually create a deposit in itself. Lord Turner, the former head of the UK FSA, said that banks do not, as many textbooks still suggest, take deposits of existing money from savers and lend it out to borrowers. They create credit and money ex nihilo from nothing, extending a loan to the borrower and simultaneously crediting the borrower's money account. And this is illustrated in the diagram, shown quite simply in the form of a mortgage offset account. So imagine you're a customer with an existing mortgage on your home. You decide to increase the size of your mortgage. We would, as a bank, deposit those proceeds into your offset account, and you've grossed up your balance sheet through both additional borrowing an additional asset being the offset balance, and so has the bank. So a new deposit's actually been formed through that process, and that deposit has been formed as a result of the decision of you as the consumer to borrow, and therefore the bank to respond to that through the provision of the loan. Now, this is a fairly complex area, and in the time that I've got available, I can really only just lay out the concept. There's a lot of research, particularly the Bank of England working papers, and I certainly don't want to suggest that credit creation is the only way in which deposits are created, but the current research suggests that it's the dominant factor at the system level in a modern financial economy. So then the question is, how do we actually see this in practice? So the first chart shows the deposit and lending growth in Australia over time, as you can see, running back to 1991. And although there's a correlation between the two, the relationship is not that perfect. On the right-hand side there, the chart shows the percentage change in UK balance sheets. On the x-axis, you've got the change in assets, and on the y-axis, you've got the change in bank debt. And that's all forms of bank funding. And it's shown, and you can see the relationship between the two, as evidenced by the red dots there. Very strong relationship with minimal variance. So when assets increase, bank debt increases. When assets decrease, bank debt decreases. And the same relationship holds in other countries examined through that Bank of England study that I referred to. So importantly, the magnitude of the increase and the decrease in balance sheet size, you know, the grossing up and grossing down, is larger than that predicted by the conventional economic models. So what we're seeing is that bank funding volumes are related to bank assets, but the relationship is not perfect, and we haven't really shown you yet which comes first. So what we've done on this particular slide is we've adjusted credit growth for the bank funding of Australia's current account deficit, and the deposit proxy is simply credit growth and the bank funding of the current account deficit. And in this model, our deposit proxy explains, in our view, most of the movement in deposit volume. And here's where we think it gets interesting. So Granger causality tests do not suggest an increase in deposit competition by banks increasing system deposit growth. However, they do suggest that credit growth, Granger causes deposit growth, which is consistent with that theory. That is, the direction of the causality is from credit growth to deposit growth. So what role for price? Now, in this particular chart, there's some shaded lines which somehow not, unfortunately, come up in the slide. But again, I'm talking about a theoretical system here. But essentially, and this is no guidance on our approach to pricing, but essentially, higher prices in system deposits are not associated with higher volumes in the deposit system. So what this chart shows is, apart from one aberration, and I'll see if I can get the aberration, is that period there, is that deposit price does not correspond with periods where deposit growth is faster than that of asset growth. So this is a relationship between loan growth and deposit growth. But essentially what it's saying is that relationship between loan growth and deposit growth is not influenced by pricing. There's only been one aberration in the 32-year period of this study that would go against that. So price still has a role, but not in the immediately intuitive way that you would expect, that increased price, increased demand. What we're saying is that doesn't hold true in this particular market. So any change that increases the cost of assets or reduces lending in any other way will also impact deposit growth. Again, the Bank of England said regulatory changes, including those that raise the cost of funding, can have an impact on and potentially a negative impact on deposit growth. At this point, I'll probably highlight that there's still a lot we don't know about the deposit system here, and these findings are fairly preliminary, and some early stages of our research that we're doing through our economics team, but leveraging off some of that research that I referred to earlier. We think there's a lot more work to be done on this space in terms of really understanding what drives deposits. It's fundamentally critical for the system, and I think, you know, through this work it will help inform policy decisions across the industry generally. I just want to say a few words on unquestionably strong, and I guess from our perspective it's a multi-dimensional issue. As you recall from the Financial System Inquiry and the government response, which was released in October 2015, an important recommendation endorsed by the government was that bank capital ratios are unquestionably strong by being in the top quartile of internationally banks. So we certainly agree with this notion of being unquestionably strong, as I talked about earlier, the need to be presenting a very strong story about our system, about our banking, about our banks, and about the individual banks is critical to our ongoing health and the ability to support the Australian economy. I guess our perspective here is that there are a range of different actors that will consider whether we're unquestionably strong, and that the dimensions of a resilient bank are not just about capital, they cut across a range of aspects, certainly funding, liquidity, earnings, asset quality, our ability to both conduct and respond to stress tests, how concentrated our risk profile is, our strategy, our competence as management, and our ability around risk management, the reputation that we have, and also the strength of the governance frameworks and really how that plays out in terms of conduct and culture are all important aspects when we're thinking about what is a resilient bank. And for us, a resilient bank is a bank that's unquestionably strong, and an unquestionably strong bank is one that is resilient. But depending on the stakeholder, whether it's deposit customers or payment, or those customers are relying on us for payment services, whether it's our equity investors or our debt investors, they'll all each have a different perspective where they sit in terms of both tenor and capital stack as to those issues. So I guess our perspective is that where a bank lands on each of these measures could be used as a mechanism to notch up or notch down depending on where their capital ratios are. But we certainly know that APRA are doing a lot of work on this at the moment, and we look forward to sort of continuing to engage and share our view with APRA on this very important issue. And lastly, I think, as I said, we're in a period of significant change. Prudential regulation has really dominated the banking landscape for since 2009, and certainly the Basel Committee looking to finalise their recommendations towards the end of this year. I guess we wait to see how that plays out. Certainly we're engaged at the industry level internationally as well with input into those. And ultimately, they're all heading in the right direction. That is a safer, stronger banking system, which is what we need. We continue to, I guess, think about our future state balance sheet and how we optimise that within the envelope of regulatory change that are described. And we're certainly very committed to a safer, stronger and more resilient banking system, which is the objective of all of this change. So I will bring my remarks to a close and hand back to Peter, and happy to take some further questions in the Q&A time. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Sean. That's going to lead to some really interesting Q&A later on, I think. So our next speaker is going to dig a bit more into this bubble question that offshore investors are always curious about that Sean mentioned, is Peter Jolly. Peter is the Global Head of Research in our Global Markets area in NAB. His team specialist researchers cover across the world in different economies and look at interest rates and currency markets all over the place. He has worked as an economist and researcher for more than two decades, and he started out with the Central Bank of New Zealand. He's an honorary fellow at Macquarie University and has a master's degree in economics from the University of London. Would you join me in welcoming Peter to take this next session?
Thank you, Peter. Good to be here. I must say, I didn't choose this topic. I mean, Bubble Tall in Trouble, but I've decided to embrace it. So so really, I guess that the topic speaks to, I think, what on many people's minds increasingly these days is, you know, the rise in house prices that we've seen, you know, around Australia. So I want to talk through that. I want to talk two bits, really. One is to think about first what Tall in Trouble might really be. I mean, and then to put hopefully into that context, you know, what we've seen in Australia in house prices over the last couple of decades. I want to start with, and I've got a lot of slides which we hopefully will talk our way through. I want to start with this rather stunning chart, really. This is the median house price for Australia's eight capital cities. It's a joyous chart if you own one or two of them. I mean, and a miserable chart if you don't. Or you haven't. But you can see house prices have risen pretty dramatically over a long period. In fact, I was just measuring before I came in. So if we went back 20 years ago, the median house price was about $140,000 across the eight capital cities in Australia. It's around about, you know, about 550,000 now. It's sort of increased four times in two decades, okay? The stock market's gone up a similar, well, actually pretty similar amount in that 20-odd year period, you know, 3.5 times it was its original value in 1996. But both of those have significantly outstripped, for instance, the consumer price index was only up sort of 60-odd percent, and 10% of that was actually the GST. So by any measure, you know, asset prices have had a pretty good performance over the last 20-odd years in Australia. And the other thing I've got on the slide here, and I haven't really picked them out deliberately, but I've just sort of put a few doomsayers along the path. I mean, and the warnings about Australia's housing markets have started a long time ago. And I grabbed that quote from 03 where the IMF warned about a variety of housing markets, I mean, because prices have risen steeply. They got a couple right because the US was a good warning. I mean, but Australia hasn't proven to be, so far at least, hasn't had the risks, I guess, of the declines we've seen in the US. And I picked out Steve Keane, I mean, and Jeremy Grantham as a sort of a famed US investor. Now, I haven't picked on them in particular because, in fact, I suspect some of those warnings have been quite useful along the way. I mean, in terms of making people think, you know, about price and about, you know, the value of you know, what is a house and the underlying value as we go through. So I don't mean to pick on them in particular, but I would observe one thing, and that is that just simply because the price of something's gone up doesn't mean it's a bubble. I mean, I think that's the point I would make. I mean, we've seen a very long run up in house prices, and just because something's gone up doesn't mean it's, you know, a bubble and about to collapse. Some things can go up for fundamental reasons. I mean, it can go up for fundamental reasons or maybe speculative reasons. So that's my big take there. And the other thing, I want a couple of slides here, just in case you think I am an apologist for Australian house prices. I showed you eight capital cities, the average. I mean, and there were a lot of bumps along the way. But when you unpack the eight capital cities, you'll realise very quickly that there's no single housing market in Australia. Sydney and Melbourne sort of grab your eyes there, but if you look closely, I mean, prices are actually falling in Darwin and have been sort of flat to falling in Perth as well. So it's not like all house prices have gone up in Australia by four times over the last 20-odd years. We have seen periods where they've gone up, and, you know, generally up, but in some cases down, and they're falling now for fundamental reasons. Here goes what would have happened if you'd bought up some prices in the resource towns. So this is what we've got. Port Hedland, Karratha have had sort of precipitous declines. You know, there was a sort of a famed house we used to show in some of our presentations, which was a sort of a five-row house that sold in Port Hedland for $1.2 million when iron ore was $180 a tonne back in 2011, which sold a year ago for $325,000. I mean, something of that order. So fundamentals, supply and demand, a whole bunch of other factors will drive an asset price and house prices in this case. The other thing I want to say is that, so point being there that there is no single housing market, and just because prices have gone up doesn't necessarily mean it's a bubble. The other thing I would quickly add, though, is Australia is not special. I mean, Australia has had decent bubbles in the past. I quite enjoyed reading about this, actually, people know about the. There's been a lot of humps and hollows along the way, but it was a spectacular asset boom and bust in the late 1800s. It's actually across Australia generally, but in Melbourne particularly. This shows you. This is the great work of Nigel Stapleton at UNSW, who painfully put together these house price series all the way back to 1880, and you can see we saw a 45 or more or less half house prices halved between 1890 and about 1894. I mean, in a two-year space in Melbourne, they halved actually, and we saw similar, well, almost, you know, proportional declines, and, you know, near 30%, and just after that, or around about that's the time of the Depression. So we're not special. I mean, like, so I'm not saying just because they've gone up doesn't mean they can't come down. They have come down in the past. I just, if you look at this, what happened in Melbourne, I mean, in that period, I've just given you a quote. It was a nice paper by, I'm going to read a little bit from it, actually, from John Simon from the RBA, an RBA researcher. He wrote about 10 years ago, and he said, this is a bit of a germ in a sense. You know, like often that whenever you see large house price gains, they're usually sparked by something kind of real. And we saw this great explosion, as it says there, in the population of Melbourne. You know, up 70% in a few years' time, in a few years' space. We also saw a concurrent, very large stock market boom going on. So there's a housing market boom and a stock market boom going on. And the crash began in 1891. And as Mr. Simon says, the exact trigger of it, you weren't exactly, you know, there was no obvious great trigger for it. But a couple of things that were true. One was that reputable banks started to tighten their lending. I mean, in about, was it 1887? The actual boom went on for another 3 or 4 years, but you found that there was these apparently land banks, special term, who just lent on land, got their funds from overseas, were more at the speculative end, and also bought property themselves, actually. So they carried on, if you like, weaker lending practices carried on, which left the boom go on. And then fundamentally, but by the end of this period, we were always seeing, you know, yields on property declining, asset prices going up too much, and ultimately we had cash flow issues with investors who were buying properties and they were paying more for the interest, you know, if you like, than they were earning in the yields. And so ultimately we drove to a point. And anyway, by 1991, it became a full-blown, you know, decline in prices. Mortgage defaults went up, and as they said, it became turned into a more general depression. So Australia is not immune, is the other point I would make. What is an asset bubble? Now there's a lot of research that is going, in fact, more and more research going on to what an asset bubble might be. There's a couple of things, you know, that one of them, they're very difficult to predict. They're almost always easy to see out the rear vision mirror than they are, you know, in front of you in the car, if you like. But here's some common or some things that have sort of built up, and I've got a few quotes here which I think sort of are helpful. I mean, Charles Lindenberger, so he was he wrote the famous book on manias, panics, and crashes, said a bubble can be loosely defined as a sharp rise in the price of an asset or a range of assets, with the initial rise generating expectations of further rises and attracting new buyers. Generally, speculators are interested in profits for trading rather than earnings. So it has taken on another life over and above, you know, what the fundamental reason for the asset might be, if you like. Yeah, Reinhardt and Rogoff, who are, you know, pretty famed historians of the last 600 years of booms and busts, in terms of, you know, banking cycles, government debt cycles, they kind of added that, and the common theme, one is the price rises, but the other thing is the most common theme is it's always has debt attached. So there's always, you know, like that's when it becomes dangerous. Because, and Glenn Stevens sort of added to this, you know, sagely a few years ago, actually. So he says it's not so much the asset price in his view, it is the debt, it is the leverage behind it. My guess is that if you had an asset bubble and, say, some new exotic art, and there's no borrowing, it's not going to do much damage to the broader economy. So, and then he added a few weeks ago in his sort of valedictory sort of interview with the Wall Street Journal, he says, you care, of course, whether asset prices seem divorced from their fundamentals. That's often in the eye of the beholder, so it's very hard to kind of work that out in some ways. But the thing you care most about is if there's a lot of borrowed money behind the asset. So that's the kind of the key to it. So if I was to say, you know, taking a few of those things together. So what would be a more useful definition of, you know, toil and trouble? I mean, on the theme, it's not only has the asset risen, or not only has an asset risen above its fundamental value, again, it's sort of hard to do, or often hard, or Glenn Stevens says that's in the eye of the beholder. We can think about that from a number of ways. And from a housing perspective, I think you think about things like, demand for housing, supply of housing, valuations, what's happening to mortgage rates. These might all be fundamental factors that have driven house prices to a point. So we need an asset that sits above, it's sort of divorced, in Glenn Stevens' terms, away from its fundamental value. And I think the other key to it is it has to be driven by what we say excessive debt accumulation. And I think the other one is key is, which is, you know, basically by poor lending standards. So that's a pretty common theme if you look at even more recent crises. I mean, clearly the subprime lending crisis that we saw in the United States had, you know, poor lending standards attached to that. So factors to consider there might be credit growth, lending standards, how not so easy to define. We have good measures of those in the United States and Europe, where they actually survey bank lending officers. I've got some quotes later on just to talk to you about that. And also things like employment and income growth. I mean, a house price might go up because income all of a sudden doubles and people can more easily service their mortgages and the likes. So there's some things to think about, I think, when comparing, you know, that would be the definition of getting into toil and trouble. So how do we, in Australia today, I mean, I was just going to look back now, what has driven, if you like, our housing market over the last 10 or 20 years? I have a few things that I think have been pretty important. One, these are my three factors. I mean, one has been the very low mortgage rates that we've seen. So mortgage rates have, of course, declined an awful lot, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years. And now the lowest level, we've actually basically ever seen, or certainly on recorded history that I've got, which has improved affordability. We've had foreign demand, and I'll show you a slide on that. Most obviously people from China have been buying properties, particularly on the eastern seaboard here. And the other third one was that we had, for certainly a period, population growth very much outstripping the supply of residential dwellings. Now, I think that, to me, when I look at these factors here, I think these are the factors that have driven house prices up in some of the markets that we look at. Point two, some of these things are waning. It's pretty clear, and I hope to explain it as we go through. I think point two is definitely waning. The foreign demand story is definitely waning. And I think the other one, what's very clear to us when we look at it, is that what was absolutely true, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, where population had very much outstripped the supply of housing, that is not true at all now. In fact, I mean, the thing is, generally it's closed up across the nation. And in certain markets, I think we're definitely heading into some oversupply. So I hope to speak to some of those points as we go. Mortgage rates. So here we go. This is a chart, quick chart of mortgage rates. Back to, as far as I could get, 1960. You can see I've got a couple of measures here. One's just the standard variable and then the discounted variable. But these are more or less the lowest mortgage rates that we've seen. And I would think that over the next couple of years, they're probably going to stay where they are, maybe even a little bit lower would be my guess. So we're not seeing interest rate, no great pressure to push up on the interest rate side. Now, on the right, I've shown you one of these measures. I must admit I'm not a massive fan of them, housing affordability measures. But they simply ask the question, you know, given someone's income growth, employment, and mortgage rates, and also thinking about the dwelling prices. If you were meant to service a mortgage, if you like, here, there's three basic inputs: the dwelling price, your income, and then the interest rate. Yeah. So if you tie all those things together, you can create some index of affordability. And in this slide here, this is put together by HIA. You can see as the line goes down, housing becomes more affordable, and as it goes up, it becomes less affordable. The battle, housing has become a little bit less affordable over the last 10 years, but you can see back in 08, 09, it was particularly cheap. And then mortgage rates have declined. Even as dwelling prices have gone up, mortgage rates have been declining to offset that, if you like. Yeah. Income growth has not been that strong. But I mean, overall, housing affordability, if you believe a measure like this, is around average. Yeah, I mean, around very long run averages. And in fact, over the last 2 or 3 years, you can see we've been dotting around the median for the last 3 years. So effectively, the rise in house prices that we've seen, or dwelling prices that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years, has almost been entirely offset by the decline in mortgage rates. Effectively, that's really what's happening. Now, the reason I'm not a big fan of these, I mean, that's true. If all you ever want to do is pay back your mortgage, what it doesn't tell you a little bit is around the size of the household balance sheet. I mean, so the household, you know, you may be paying back a mortgage, okay, but of course your stock of debt is going up quite a lot. I mean, we'll talk to that in a second. So undoubtedly it's true that even though affordability hasn't shifted at all over the last 3 years, I think the vulnerability of the household sector has gone up a little bit just because there's a bit more stock, you know, debt, if you like, the debt on the balance sheet is a bit higher. But anyway, that's the positive of mortgage, of lower interest rates. How about foreign demand? I have this sort of, this is a nice chart. You can, I call it cities by the sea. It's really cities by the Pacific. I mean, you know, there's a real favoured group of cities by Asian and particularly Chinese investors, or countries at least, where they would like to go and live. I mean, you can go onto this, if you care to search jiawai.com, then you can see the most searched countries, and then by country, you know which cities are most favoured by Chinese-based investors. Australia sits number two. Little old New Zealand, where I come from, sits number four, which I find astonishing. I mean, given you know how small New Zealand is relative to how big China is, I mean, and why you see ongoing pressures. And then so Australia sat number two as the second most searched and desired place for someone, you know, in China who wants to live abroad to go and live. And then by city, you can see Melbourne's number one, Sydney, and so forth. So there's been a real strong demand, and we know from foreign buyers. And I just cheekily given you this slide there to show you that Sydney, Vancouver, Auckland have all moved in roughly the same magnitude. I'm not saying all of that is driven by foreign buyers, but I mean, I think an element of that is driven by foreign buyers. This source is slowing a little bit. There's a lot of conjecture about, you know, the size of that bid, if you like, the foreign bid. There's not a lot of good data around this, but NAB does a survey, which I think is as good as anyone's data. I mean, where we do a survey of residential people involved in the residential property sector every quarter, and we ask a range of questions. But one of those questions we ask of people is, you know, the source of new buyers for new developments. We do it also for existing developments. And I've just shown you here, going from the left, it's first home buyers, owner-occupier, first home buyers, investors, resident owner-occupiers, Australian investors, and then overseas buyers there. I mean, one point to make here is that it's not like many of the newspaper headlines would tell you. In some ways, they would tell you that the most dominant buyers foreign buyers, it's far from that. But even at that 10-15% percentage, it's still a pretty hefty, you know, it's only a sizable proportion. The other point I would make around this is that, but it's clearly declining as well. I mean, so we have seen a bit of a slowdown. If I trace that slide back a bit further, I think we were sort of about 15, 16, 17% a few years ago. So we've seen a general decline. I think a couple of reasons why. I've just got shown you there on the right. I mean, the Commonwealth Government is administering the foreign buying rules a bit more strictly. Of course, they can always buy new developments. A number of the banks have, for their own prudential reasons, have become a bit more, less keen to give mortgages to foreigners. And it's true, actually, the state governments have been cashing in a little bit on the foreign buyers as well. The other thing, feedback I've had as well, is that Australia is no longer cheap. I mean, often people sitting in China used to think about it in their own currency terms. So in terms of what does something cost in RMB per square meter? And so you're comparing Shanghai, Beijing to Sydney or Melbourne in that case. And for all the time that we were seeing this rise in domestic house prices in Australia, we were actually seeing the Australian dollar decline. But that's become less true over the last year. So in fact, the Australian dollar's gone up against RMB, and you've seen a bit of a going up in terms of dwelling prices. So there's a bit of a sticker shock if you're sitting in China and parts. Anyway, however it is, there's been a bit of a slowdown. And of course, people also know it's a bit hard to get money out of China these days. So there's been a bit of a slowdown from that source. The other source, I think, which has probably, to me, been the key, has just been the supply-demand imbalance in the housing sector. And I just want to quickly go through this, just to show you that it's really caught up. This shows you dwelling approvals. We just got another number today, which was also another very big uptick in apartment approvals. But you can see that housing approvals have been pretty, you know, around about the long run averages, but seen a really huge uptick in apartment approvals over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. And I'm the next to record levels. And the next slide here, I'm just going to show you what that looks like against population. So the red line there is that total dwelling approvals number. And the black line, so this is per quarter, if you like, yeah? You know, about 50-odd thousand per quarter, I mean, and has gone up. The black line is the growth in the Australia's population per quarter, which was very quick through 08, 09 during the mining kind of boom and has subsequently slowed. During that, when we saw that big gap where there was a lot of growth in the population relative to, it was actually a slowdown in the residential construction sector. We saw an explosion, as I show you, in prices, rents, you know, vacancy rates crushed, all those types of things. But now those lines are closing in on each other. So the population growth has slowed and we're doing record kind of approvals and record construction. Again, you have to be a bit granular. It's not true for this is across the nation. If you go by state, it's a bit of a different story, state by state. Population growth still outstrips, in New South Wales at least, dwelling approvals, as is true of Victoria. But you can see there's been this big collapse in the supply-demand imbalance if you're sitting in WA or even Queensland. Now, the other thing I would add around this is that people do these sophisticated modelings around, you know, when they look at these supply-demand kind of stories and they go, well, you know, we work out what the household formation rate is, what's the population growth rate, and how many dwellings are being approved. And I remember seeing some of these numbers, even recently, saying, well, Australia's still short 100,000, 200,000 dwellings. I mean, I'm a bit wary of those calculations because they're very sensitive to the inputs that you make, yeah? But there's a very clear way we can resolve this because it strikes me that the clearing price, if you like, the clearing price for a place to live is not the capital value of the home. It's actually what's happening to rents. So whatever's happening in the rental market will tell you very clearly how the supply demand and, you know, how supply demand is. If rents are rising, I would say that this demand's far outstripping, you know, supply and vice versa. So if you look at what's happening to the rental market, it tells you very clearly to me that the big supply-demand imbalance that we saw across the country that existed a few years ago has more or less closed up. We now have rents declining in Darwin and Perth, and they're growing at the slowest pace across the country in 20-odd years. In all cities in Australia, rents have slowed, you know, quite sharply over recent years. The ones where they're growing the quickest is in Sydney and Melbourne, but even those growth rates were, you know, half or less what they were a few years ago. So I think it's a pretty clear sign that supply demand has caught up, if not across every market, but sort of as a general point. And I think we're entering into oversupply in certain markets. I mean, most obviously, and other people in my bank have flagged this, you know, around some of the inner city apartment markets and the likes, where there seems to be, you know, a lot of supply still coming, in fact. I mean, the peak supply for some of those markets is still 12, 24 months away. The other one I just want to quickly mention is, seeing my time here, financial health. Remember we talked about what were the my toil and trouble has something divorced from fundamental value. I mean, but also what is the financial health or what are the lending standards that sit behind this? I think there's no way of getting around the fact that the Australian households are very leveraged. I mean, on any reasonable measure. I've grabbed here, there's lots of ways you can play with this data, and, you know, and we should take account of offset accounts and all these types of things. But this is a BIS data set which looks at 40 countries and it shows you household or various types of debt relative to GDP. And I've just stacked them up top to bottom here. So at least on this measure here in Q3, Australian households were the most indebted out of those 40 countries. As I say, you can play with this and make yourself feel a little bit better when you disaggregate the data and look at the deciles and take account of offsets. But the reality is it's pretty stark. I mean, that household debt is pretty high. By comparison, corporate debt and government debt is actually very low, or comparatively low in Australia. So I think coming back, there's no doubt to my mind that, you know, while coming back to those affordability measures, where I think, you know, affordability may seem around average, but I don't think it's true that I think households are a bit more vulnerable, if you like, than the average. They're a bit more vulnerable to either interest rates going up, which doesn't seem likely, or an interruption to their income, to pay those mortgages. So, and that's most likely if unemployment shot up dramatically or something of that order. But again, just because you have high household debt, I would quickly add, does not mean that that may have been driven by poor lending standards or poor debt. It's just an observation that households are a bit more vulnerable than they were. On actual lending standards, as I say, like in the US, we do get these surveys of loan officers, which are pretty helpful. I've got a quote here. Two things to show you and make the point that actually lending standards have actually tightened up over the last couple of years from the banks. Credit growth on the left show you it has growing. I mean, it's only picked up from where it was through 2012, but it's not quick on any measure relative to the past. It's actually a little bit quicker than income growth at the moment, but it's certainly not quick like you might have thought, some decades or a decade or so ago. And in fact, it's even slowed in the most recent numbers. I mean, so housing credit slowed a little bit. And I just made that point there that APRA also moved to tighten lending standards, or at least ask all the ADIs to think about both their loans to investors. In fact, they put a bit of a speed limit on those, and also even loans to owner-occupiers, that they were doing proper, interest checks, interest cover type checks as well. So we have seen a bit of a slowdown. I mean, a tightening of lending standards, if you like, from the ADIs. So where does all this leave us? I mean, I guess my big point at the start was, just because something has gone up doesn't necessarily define it as a bubble. I mean, it may have gone up for fundamental reasons or speculative reasons, you need to unpack that to some degree. And my sense is that low mortgage rates, what has driven housing up, low mortgage rates, foreign demand, and a very slow supply-side response from the construction sector were probably the reasons why we have seen house prices go up as much as they have in recent times. I think some of those supports have definitely weakened, and in fact some are going to reverse. I mean, the foreign demand has slowed for now, at least anyway. And I think it's absolutely true that the undersupply of housing that we generally saw across the nation has basically closed up. That's not to say that's true postcode by postcode, at all. I mean, it's not like that. I think generally the undersupply story is gone, and we know some postcodes will experience oversupply and some may still experience undersupply. And at the same time, I'd say mortgage lending standards have tightened. So what's NAB's view on housing? So we actually do make forecasts for this. So we think we're going to see the housing market cool appreciably over the next year or two. Like standalone houses, growth rates will slow quite a bit, and we actually see unit prices declining. But we don't hold the view, like the idea that there's some big, 20-30% decline, around the corner, I think seems kind of improbable at the moment. Here goes our forecasts. These are, if you're ever interested, these are contained in our residential construction, residential property survey, which comes out every quarter. Again, we try and take account of the local factors as well as the general factors. And just looking at that 2017 column there, much more modest house price gains in most cities and a bit of a decline or continued decline in Perth, and a bit more of a decline in some of the unit markets, where we see, some very clear oversupply. Some of those oversupplies, as I say, has been talked about in other circles, but, parts of Melbourne, parts of Brisbane, parts of Sydney look well supplied in certain postcodes by some apartments. And I am going to, as usual, disclaimer. So I'm going to stop. I'll leave it on that. That's a more interesting slide. I'm happy to stop at that point and pass over to Peter. Thank you.
Looking to the right slide here for the Q&A portion. So hopefully you all found that pretty interesting and left you some questions you're keen to get up to our two great speakers today. I think we've got a couple of mics roaming around, so I'll open to the audience and see your hand up over there.
Thanks. Peter, I got a question for you. It's really interesting to see the relative demand and supply charts that you put up. And then I guess also from the last slide on the hedonic prices, you show that I guess there's going to still be an increasing demand for housing, as in houses, yep. And probably a decreasing demand for units because of the oversupply. So I guess there's obviously the interactions of those two things satisfying the influx of people. But in general, you definitely see the trend that you're always getting more people in than you're building new capacity for. So just wondering if there's like a natural rate of vacancy that is also happening in the background, or if people start camping somewhere, or just how does that work?
So you mean a net? I mean, I've got to speak into this, yeah? look, there's vacancy rates. I mean, in terms of like dwelling vacancies, they're very cyclical. I mean, the way I think about this is that, you know, the population changes quite quickly. It can change quite quickly, and in the very short run, the supply of dwellings is fixed, and so we do see prices respond to that and rents respond to that. But of course, in the medium term, long term, certainly, the supply of dwellings is not at all fixed. You know, and so some of the supply now we're seeing coming into the market. You know, approvals that get done today will not turn up in the market for, you know, 18, 24 months away from now. And so it's always hard to get that perfect. I mean, there hasn't been, that's why we call it a cycle. There's never been a period where you match those things perfectly postcode by postcode. So it seems just inevitable consequence to me that we will see, periods of oversupply as we're heading into now. I don't know if that's really where the question was going. I mean, but
so when there's undersupply, is there just always a natural friction level that makes sure that people aren't on the streets? I guess that's probably where I'm going. If you're thinking about it as being...
If there's undersupply.
Like, well, if you don't have enough housing for people, yep. Does everyone still have a roof? Things like that.
Oh, I see what you mean. People might end up staying... household formation rates are slower. I mean, so people stay at home a bit longer, you know, go back and live with their parents. I mean, I actually haven't done that test to go and look at whether more people are sleeping on the streets. I hope that's not true. But all things have to happen is, you know, it's a bit like the easiest other way of thinking about it is I think about hotels. You know, once hotels get to certain occupancy rates and room rates, you know, a whole lot of hotels start, you know, people start building new hotels. I mean, and you move into from a shortage because prices have gone up so sufficiently that encourages people to build new hotels. I mean, it's the same thing with housing. Rents, as you saw one of those slides, rents went up dramatically. That encouraged, you know, that gave great returns to developers, and we saw new stock hit the market. But it's always with a lag. I mean, that's the issue.
Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
If I can, I've got one for Peter and two for Sean. Peter, your table of the highest household debt ratios, when you looked at it, all the ones that were really high were all the countries that have got very well-developed superannuation systems. And so I wonder whether there's not an interaction there in terms of a net debt effect that people are being forced to do long-term savings and therefore there's more in the way of debt. For Sean, I agree entirely with the thing about credit being the driver of deposits. But it seems to me there's two questions come out of that. One is, how then does the Reserve Bank control the growth of deposits and credit? And it seems to me that it perhaps comes down to the capital requirement type stuff or bank capital. But I thought you also had a slide there that showed there wasn't much relationship between the growth of bank equity and credit. And the second aspect of it is that the other way in which If an increase in credit increases deposits, a reduction in credit reduces deposits. So if I buy if I get a loan from a bank and buy a house from someone else and they pay off their mortgage, then those two things cancel out. But they may not cancel out depending on whether house prices are going up or down, and therefore depending on... And I wonder whether there's not a potential major issue if house prices start to fall in terms of what that does to that deposit credit cycle.
I can quickly answer the first question. Yes, the answer is. I mean, observationally true. I mean, so that chart's not there meant to scare you. And sometimes you should look at. There's lots of reasons why. You know, you might better explain where it is. But I mean, it's still true. I think because that's just a simple. That just adds up household debt. They're sitting on balance sheets relative to GDP. But no matter how you cut it, I still think that you've seen extra. The debt doesn't go away. Yeah, I mean, if you like, I mean, you're still a bit more vulnerable than you would have been otherwise.
Respect to the second question, so if we get a fall in house prices, what does that do to the deposit market? I think it's a really good question, and one that probably deserves a fair bit more research, because I think there is an element of I guess deposits are cancelled when you sell a house. There's a deposit cancelled there somewhere in the system. But I think the fact that asset values accreting will create some profit, which then translates into higher sale prices, which leads to higher deposits, the reverse could be true. And I think that is a system implication that we need to continue to study. How will the deposit system and the credit system behave in a downturn? And I think there's a number of other influences too. Risk aversion is a key issue. So ultimately what people choose to do in terms of purchases, the appetite for credit. I mean, I have a view that I think there's a fair amount of risk aversion in the system already. And we see that certainly in some of our credit data that the type of borrowings that companies are undertaking at the moment is quite different from where it was sort of pre-GFC. Now, there's a lot of good aspects to that, but there's also, I think, a lack of investment in creation of productive capacity, which has fundamental impacts for the system. In terms of the relationship between capital and credit, well, certainly, you know, the capital allows us to extend credit. There's no doubt about that, and the stronger capital base that we have, the stronger the balance sheet can actually be. But it also is influenced by the risk weights that are attaching to the type of lending that we do. And I think the risk weight, the IRB framework at the moment, does recognise the different risk profiles of lending to housing versus lending to corporates. And that's under some review at the moment in terms of the calibration, particularly globally, and that will have an impact on where banks start to direct their balance sheet as banks rationally respond to the signals, both in terms of capital and returns.
Great, thanks, John. Are there any more questions in the audience or the webinar at the moment? Just thought I'd check in on you guys. So you kind of talked there a bit about the risk aversion piece, and it starts getting into the credit growth creation biz, but given that the bank to an extent kind of is suggested to create their own funding at, I guess, a system level, why is there that need for the banks to be concerned about how they are funded from a deposits perspective?
Because the funding might be created by the system, but it doesn't mean that we'll necessarily get our what we think is our appropriate share for it. So in order to compete for the available funding in the market, we need to ensure that we're unquestionably strong. That is, you know, the credit profile of our organisation is certainly at the stronger end of our peer group, and certainly for the Australian system, it's at the stronger end of our international peer group. And certainly that's been an objective of ours, to position ourselves as best as possible in the bid for the available credit funding through work that we've done across our balance sheet. So as an organisation, we've done a lot to simplify our balance sheet over the last couple of years. We've sold a number of subsidiaries and assets that were a drain on both our risk profile, on our profitability, on our management time and so on. So we're moving to be a more simpler, more focused organisation with stronger capital, stronger funding and stronger liquidity, basically to position ourselves as best we possibly could. When I think, you know, certainly in my personal view, there's a reasonable hypothesis that 2018 will be weaker than 2016. Certainly that's my view. But also we need to ensure that the type of funding that we access is the right sort of funding as well. So, you know, if the only funding available is short-term overnight, that's not suitable for us or the system. That creates unacceptable risks in terms of maturity and concentration. And for us, you know, the fundamental risk that we're looking to manage overall is liquidity risk. That's what brings banks undone. So managing to have a very strong balance sheet to ensure that we can access the right type of funding, both in terms of amount and profile, is particularly important.
Okay. See another
Robert.
One moment, we'll just get a microphone.
This is for Peter.
Sorry, you. Pardon me, just on the funding issue, you alluded to the limitations. Sorry.
Yep.
Limitations around the domestic institutional market or the domestic market for the raising of debt. It seems to have been a long-term issue in the sense that domestically we don't go out very far and et cetera. So do you see that changing at all?
Well, I think
what
we have
do you
to,
think we need to change?
Well, I think we do have to try and make a change. I certainly think we need to get longer tenor in the profile of the bond market in Australia. And I think, you know, we've certainly been investing in trying to develop a more robust corporate bond market in Australia, and you know, that's proved really problematic. We also need to get the superannuation industry much more actively involved in the purchase of debt instruments than they have been. As there is a bias in the industry towards equity. We as an industry need to do more to bring the superannuation industry more to the banks in terms of buying bonds. And that's where we're going to put more focus over the next couple of years. But certainly, you know, superannuation funds are going to be the natural holder of some of the longer-term infrastructure assets, as you know from your experience, that they're probably better placed to hold some of those assets than we are. But we've got to find a way of opening up that market more than we've been able to do so to date. So.
Whole bundle.
Sean, just a question for you, just around the whole, you know, creations of deposits through loans, et cetera. Is that, a domestic thing, or could those deposits, as you said, you're obviously competing for those and your organisation won't necessarily get them. Is there leakage offshore for that which could upset that model, or...?
Look, there could be. We're still in the early stages of some of this research, but I think the Australian system is somewhat different from some of the other markets. So structurally, we have a different component or different... nature of our deposit system than many of the other regions. So a lot of banks will have deposit books that are greater than their loan books. Certainly in Australia that's not the case. The sort of natural level of deposits to loans is about 70 cents. We've got the superannuation industry, which I talked to. Some of the other markets, we've got vehicles that will buy mortgages from banks, where typically in Australia we will hold those mortgages in ourselves. So the extent of leakage, to your question, that from the Australian deposit system offshore probably only occurs through the superannuation market that I can think of in terms of actually what goes into offshore equities. But there's always going to be an element of diversification that they have in terms of their investment profiles. There's probably not a lot we can do to reverse that, but I think what we can do is, as they grow, try and attract them to new asset classes for those, which will be bonds.
Yeah. I was just going to add, I mean, there's always going to be a shortfall in the Australian system because naturally we rely on foreign capital. I mean, as a country, you know, we have, it's not a bad thing. I mean, we have many investment opportunities in Australia. I mean, in fact, if you look at the numbers, household or the general savings rate of Australians is actually very comparable to many other countries. But we have a very high rate of investment. I mean, a lot of investment opportunities in Australia. So we naturally acquire or naturally need foreign capital. That's what we call the current account deficit. So that's why it would be very rare, as Sean said, than some other countries where you have deposit books above loan books. I can't see that happening in Australia. I mean, they would almost tell us that we've run out of investment opportunities in this big, big country, which I doubt it. Yeah.
I think we'll go to the gentleman in the yellow tie. Then there's another question in the middle.
Can we just unpack the superannuation a little bit and look specifically at self-managed super funds and how they're behaving in your efforts to attract deposits and lengthen that that sort of time horizon?
I can just give you the observational pieces that, you know, in Sean's case, I know the general, Australia's a very equitised, as we say, equitised culture. And one of the things I see, I spend a lot of time in the fixed income, the traditional bond market. And if you look at what we would call pure fixed income, there's actually a very small percentage. I mean, I think off the top of my head, it might be, you know, 10 or 15% in Australia, which might be devoted to that pure senior bond with maturity, whereas you might go to, you know, Europe and it might be north of 50-odd%, you know. So we do have a very big difference in terms of the asset mix, which I don't think is going to change. And some of that's tax, some of that's just history, familiarity with asset classes. I don't think that's going to change quickly, but it might be my pick.
Yeah.
And certainly SMSF is not a huge part of our deposit, not a big part of our deposit base, so I'm probably not really able to comment too much on that question, but I think it's a good question.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, just curious, you mentioned in the housing market it all seems to be okay so long as there's no external shocks. I wonder, are we too complacent about there is an external shock coming? You hear our Federal Treasurer talking about the Chinese economy. Should we be more sensitive to a shock and take it a bit, there's a bit more sense of urgency perhaps?
I think we should always be alert and be aware, and I think we have become more so. That's why I showed you that, you know, APRA, you know, asked banks to tighten lending standards. I mean, in the face of a shock like that, you would hope, as Sean runs for the NAB, I mean, has lots of capital and lots of safety in the system. How does that mean you still got to do something? I mean, like, that's what. If you're too worried about all the shocks, you wouldn't do anything in some kind of way. The other thing I do think is, you know, like, I know the bank, we do, lots of people do stress testing. I mean, the greatest shock strikes me is a big lift in unemployment in Australia. And it's worth just pointing out, though, I mean, how resilient the system's already been, because back in 2008, the unemployment rate in Australia touched 4%. I mean, it seems a long time ago now. A year ago, it was 6.25%. It's now just under 6%. So we rose from 4% to 6.25%, you know, pretty hefty. If you're sitting back when it was 4%, you would say that was a pretty sizable increase. But we saw arrears, bank mortgage arrears, actually decline through that period. So the system, I would say, is, you know, pretty resilient to that. That was one shock. Yeah, if unemployment goes to 10 or 12%, of course, that's a very different matter. I mean, I think we do think about those shocks. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the great developments in banking and risk management really over the last 10 years, I think, has been the shift from backward-looking risk management in terms of counting loss rates and looking at what was incurred in terms of bad and doubtful debts over the prior period to a much more forward-looking view of risk management. And that's really informed by stress testing and scenarios. And so we and the industry have invested heavily in stress testing capability, basically to try and identify, and two of my colleagues in the audience here have been heavily involved in that, but looking at the ability of an organisation to withstand a series of shocks, extreme but plausible shocks that could come from a variety of areas, whether it's offshore, whether it hits the exchange rate, whether it hits commodity prices, unemployment, inflation. It's by very nature, it's very hard to predict where that shock is, but by the process of stress testing and applying a range of scenarios, you understand the resilience of your capital base to those shocks, and more particularly the response mechanisms that banks have at their disposal to restore both capital funding and liquidity in the event that there is a shock. So we do a lot of work internally in terms of sizing up our capital. We share that work with our regulators. Our regulators require us to run scenarios that they also prescribed, all with a view of making sure that we're looking forward all the time at what could happen, rather than what I think was a practice, you know, 10 years before and in the past of being overly backward looking in terms of what has happened. So I think we're absolutely sort of match fit in terms of understanding what can go wrong with the balance sheet, and more particularly how we respond. I don't think we're complacent. I think what we've all done, and certainly we have, is continue to tighten our credit policies in areas where we see, as you know, Peter outlined, parts of the market exhibiting characteristics that start to cause you to question the capacity of asset quality being maintained in those particular subsectors of the portfolio. So, you know, housing's a good one. You know, there's not a blanket approach you can take to a market that's very different between towns that are single industry towns or Sydney or others, but it's about being aware of the micro detail of your portfolio, applying appropriate and prudent policies, but more particularly testing all the time for the unexpected events, and that's what stress testing does for us.
Thanks, Sean. So I think we've got time for probably one more question before we go to break, so there's one over there.
Sorry, just a very high-level question. Given you said there are The household debt is high and APRA has an eye on it. So what is the current focus from NAB at the moment? Are you able to share with us? Like, will that be changing balance sheet composition in order to respond to those changes in regulations?
We set a strategy. Our strategy is, I think our CEO has been very public in terms of what our strategy is to focus on our core markets in Australia and New Zealand and essentially, you know, to support all aspects of the Australian economy. Clearly, how we position the balance sheet will be influenced by a range of factors. Regulation is part of that, but also, you know, the external environment and the performance of each of those sectors. But we take a long-run view of the performance of the economy, and as a, you know, a major part of the Australian financial system, we're there to support the overall economy.
So if price, like you said, price doesn't drive the more deposits, so what are the elements that you factor in to drive?
Yeah, I guess what we're trying to say in our research is intuitively price is not the main driver of deposits, but there are a number of factors, and the extension of credit is a dominant driver of that. That doesn't mean that we don't consider all of the aspects of what can continue to support the deposit market generally.
Great. Well, I'd like you all to join me in thanking our two great speakers for our first plenary today.